What's the advantage of finding texts when you are studying a Roman quarry? Well, this should be obvious, but what exactly do we learn about the function of a given quarry that we would otherwise not know? First, what do I mean by text? Most quarries have delivered inscriptions. We've already heard a great deal about them. But I shall talk about more ephemeral writings, like Elens, happens to be the same, which could be on papyrus, but are in fact nearly always on ostraca. And by quarry, just to be sure, in this context, I mean the larger imperial quarries, and not just the local quarries that you find next to any camp, regardless of the quality of the stone, and they were sort of simply used to build a camp. Well, of course, what I know best is Mons Claudianus, which you see again here. But I shall also touch on the small quarry of Umballad, in which I'm working at the moment, or the text thereof. There are about 700 ostraca from Mons Porphyritus that should be interesting in this context also, but they are not published yet. For comparison, I've chosen the imperial marble quarries at Dukimium in Turkey, where I've not been, and those at Simitus Shimtu in Tunisia, which I've seen for myself. So, as sources to how quarries functioned, we have, of course, first of all, the archaeology. That's the tool marks on the stone, which tell us which tools were used and generally how the stone was quarried. As for writing, most quarries deliver inscriptions of the more or less monumental kind. For instance, a founding inscription over the gate or of the fortified camp, which I thought was the case of the Domitianic inscriptions just until a moment ago. And I still happen to think perhaps yes, but anyway, let's leave that aside. This will mostly tell us when the enterprise was begun or a significant change took place. We have such inscriptions from Mons Claudianus, I thought, and from Umballad, I know, though in both cases they are broken to such a degree that they're almost useless. Other inscriptions may commemorate the founding of temples, altars, wells, or the like. Such inscriptions are known both from Mons Claudianus, from Porphyritus, and from Simitus. From Dukimion, we have only quarry marks, since the quarries are much disturbed by modern work. Quarry marks are found in all quarries. They are short, almost coded messages cut into the detached blocks or into the bedrock and serve a number of purposes. Those written on the bedrock itself will often contain the name of the quarry, or rather the individual work face. Those written on the detached blocks mostly tell us whether the block in question has been approved or rejected, as the case may be, perhaps where it was quarried, and sometimes a date. Often there are numbers which can, for the most part, not be understood. Or we can't understand them at any rate. Here there are differences between the quarries that I take into consideration. First of all, the Egyptian quarries are in the Greek-speaking part of the empire, or at least mostly Greek-speaking. Simitus, in the province of Africa, has wholly Latin-speaking. In Dukimion, perhaps surprisingly, the quarry marks are in Latin. In both Mons Porphyritus and Mons Claudianus, the quarry marks show a mixture of Greek and Latin. Neither are properly published. I have a list of those from Porphyritus given to me by the excavators, and the somewhat disastrous publication of the quarry marks from Mons Claudianus is the result of a misunderstanding between the editors. The late lamented Peacock thought that the provisional list was a finished publication and proceeded to publish it without the benefit of a Greek typeface. The result is all but useless, or perhaps sometimes worse than useless, not least because the quarry marks are in a mixture of Greek and Latin. As for the quarry marks from Mons Porphyritus, they are different from anything I've seen elsewhere. This is from the Lycabettus quarries, as far as I could mount. It's the sequence to, ro, phi. It's seen several times. It's clearly Greek, and I have no idea what it means. There's the sequence RPP, on the other hand. We find it several times in Porphyritis, and here it is from Umballad. I have found it, yes. It's on a stray block there, lying around. If we take it to mean ratio porphyritica probata, it would be evidence that Umballad was part of the same administrative unit as the nearby Porphyritis, which would in itself not be surprising. This takes us to the RACLP, which, believe it or not, is what is written there, which is often, very often indeed, seen at Mons Claudianus. And this would then mean Ratio Claudiana Probata, an approved block on the account of Mons Claudianus, or the Claudianus quarries. In the quarry of Umballad, there are remarkable absence of quarry marks, except for the RPP already mentioned. Unlike Mons Claudianus, there is no storage area for approved but not yet exported blocks, so the search for quarry marks was carried out on the four failed blocks that lie around in the quarry, so it's not surprising that there are no marks of approval. And since only one quarry appears to have been working, at least at the time, it's not surprising that there are no marks of provenance either. But is all this useful for the understanding of the organization of quarries? Can it show us anything about the layout of the quarries and the order in which they were exploited? Well, as so often, yes and no, it depends. I shall try to be a little clearer. In Ducimium, as far as I understand, the quarries are still worked, and the modern work has almost totally destroyed the traces of the layout of the Roman quarries. But the quarry marks that are found on detached and discarded blocks show us the following designations: Officina, Brachium, Locus, Caesura, and Ratio. I will not go into the discussion about the meaning in detail of these terms or their hierarchy. Some may have been administrative units, while others probably have a precise topographical meaning. In Symmetus, a similar system appears to have been used. The term brachium is absent, which may or may not be accidental. But we find officina, locus, caesura, and ratio. Even though the Shemtu quarries are less destroyed by modern working, it is not possible to get a clear idea of what they looked like in Roman times, but at least the terminology tells us what the topographical organization was similar. In Mons Claudianus, we have ample evidence, but with the ancient, both of the ancient layout and of the topographical system in use. There has been little modern quarrying, and what there has been took place after we'd had a first look around. And also, and this is important, the stone is not marble but granite, or whatever precise name that geologists prefer to give it. Where marble can be excavated both by wedging and by trenching, nowadays even by sawing with a steel wire, granite had to be wedged off. The exploitation at Mons Claudianus never goes deep, but mostly just takes off the first layer or two of useful stone. Here come some examples just to show you what it looks like for those who haven't seen it. The first ones are from Mons Claudianus. This is something like trenching, a method they don't use much. And it's, as you see, it hasn't been carried out, it's just been planned. And this is sort of benching, but basically to wedging off in two directions. And from another angle, the same quarry. This is what we see mostly, not Isabel who's standing there, but the quarrying. You use an appropriate place, and you put in your wedges. You see, here. They've cut quite deep the trench into which they've then put the wedges. And here it is a fairly common place. I don't know why they haven't. You see, the wedges have been excavated and never set. So it hasn't broken there. We don't know why. And this is a common common design you see in Mons Claudianus, a whole face where subsequent wedge orfs have tried to either round a column out or to make an even face. One can amuse oneself with designing which are previous to the others, and you nearly always get it wrong. Anyway, it's not very important. Here's from Pentelikon marble, completely different method. You see, it goes very deep. And like this one in Shemtu, same pattern, the work face going very deep and receding towards the bottom into the mountain. This is a result of using the pickaxe. When you are making a trench with the pickaxe and you have your shoulder against the mountain, you can't get it straight down. It will always go into the mountain. And this is what happens. This is from Shemtu also. Traces of modern sawing with the steel wire. You put a channel through and you put the steel wire through and around with water and sand, and off it comes in nicely almost polished surfaces. But the ancients didn't do it like that. And here, just to make sure that you've seen it, ancient wedge marks in marble at Shemtu. So, in Mons Claudianus, we have many original work faces, peacock identified, as we've heard, 130. And we know that they are individually called latomiae, stone quarries, and were given names, not numbers, but names. There does not seem to have been any subdivision. We also find the term kopi, and it is almost irresistible to take this as the equivalent of the Latin caesura. Kopi seems like caesura to have been an administrative term, not a topographical one. The same would be true of ratio or ex ratione, which would presumably just mean account. Whatever I've said so far would concern the titles. Now let's look at the subtitles of my somewhat flashy title. By this, of course, I mean the ostraca, which are a unique feature of the Egyptian quarries. Mons Claudianus has been extremely productive in this respect, and as Valerie always said, we have over 9,000, of which some 250 are directly relevant to the quarrying, and I've published them in the volume 4 of the Mons Claudianus Ostraca. Umballat has given us some 1,100, on which I'm working at present. I can already reveal that they contain very little about the actual quarrying. From Mons Porphyritis, we have about 700, and they will undoubtedly be published one day. So let us talk about Mons Claudianus. Most of the 9,000 tell us, of course, what is seen from, shall we call it, a frog eye perspective, the little man's daily daily worries. But there are a few that really tell us something more important from a slightly higher point of view, which we would never learn in any other way. One is the general list of water distribution that Hélène published in Chiron some years ago, or 10 years ago actually. It concerns a given day while the quarries were in full activity. For instance, with columns for Trajan's Forum, Basilica Ulpia, and so we are in the first decennium of the second century. This is the Forum of Trajan, of course. And this is what the ostracon looks like. It's a list of distribution of water and gives the exact number within each category of workers that were employed in the quarries and one counts a staggering 917, of whom only 60 were soldiers. The other 857 were civilians, ranging from the architect to the lowliest water carrier. We learn that there were also doctors, veterinarians, barbers, and cobblers. We also learn that there were two kinds of workers. Hélène has already talked about this. In almost equal numbers, the Pagani, that's the native paid skilled workers, mainly employed in stonemasons and smiths, and another group, almost as big, are the familia, which mostly did unskilled work, like water carrying and so forth. The interest of this text is, of course, that it tells us how much water people got, namely 6.5 liters for the highest ranks, down to 3.25 liters for stonemasons, and 2.15 liters for the unskilled, which seems surprisingly little. But it corresponds rather well to what we know from the British forces in North Africa during the Second World War. 2 pints, that is 1.136 liters per man per day in the fighting units, and for those behind the front line, between 4.5 and 6.8 liters per day, for everything except the radiators of the vehicles, a problem the Romans did not have. Here's the tabula, it is in tabular form, Mons Claudianus column to the left, British Army in the middle, and the recommendations of... No, I have turned my pacemaker off. The recommendations of the World Health Organization, which you see are quite, quite different from anything we find. Another text, this one, that gives us a slightly higher perspective is the O-Claude 841, which is a stock list of stone blocks that were available around the year 150. Here's what it looks like. There are two fragments which do not join. There must have been a lot more. It's apparently a whole pot that's been used. The handwriting belongs to a bloke called Palais, about whom we do not know much, except that he was involved in counting stones. I think this big ostracon must be his clipboard, on which he noted down what he found when he made the tour of inspection through the quarries. As you can see, the writing is distributed into irregular groups, and the color of the ink varies. I imagine that this list was afterwards copied on papyrus and in some more legible form, perhaps sent on to Rome. At the time, the quarries at Mons Claudianus had been in use for about 50 years, or perhaps even more, as imperial quarries, and had delivered blocks of especially columns to order for a number of imperial buildings in Rome. I shall not tell you what they all were because it's been said so many times already. Each of these projects had demanded a number of monolithic columns of certain size, and there would inevitably have been a lot of useful stone which just didn't correspond to the order. I suppose if these blocks would have been taken back to Rome and stored in a marble yard if they had been a marble, but it's granite. And I suppose that the transportation was more expensive than the stone itself. So the stones were left in place until somebody wanted them. If those who do not do Greek will excuse us for a moment, we shall look at one entry on the list. At the top of the image, we read Kope Epaphroditou, in fact, Kop Epaphrod. As I already said, I believe that this Kope is Kaisura and would mean share. Epaphroditos is interesting. His name occurs several times in the same in the context of quarries, both on blocks and on rock faces, and first of all on the architrave of the temple, and equally on the architrave in Mons Porphyritis. We also find his name in Wadi Hammamat on a rock face. In the two temples inscriptions from Mons Claudianus and Porphyritus, he describes himself as an imperial slave and mistotes ton metallon, that's to say, farmer of the mines and quarries. These inscriptions must date from the revival of the quarries at the beginning of the reign of Hadrian, after the Jewish revolt. So here he is again, about 30 years later. Was he still involved in the quarrying? I doubt it. But his name was apparently still attached to some blocks that were within his share. Underneath in this text is written Latomia Dionysu, heavily abbreviated, a quarry that is attested several times, but we do not know which one it was. Under this, there are four items, each preceded by a check mark, and after which follows N with a line above. This probably means an item. Sometimes, when I made the edition, for instance, I thought it could have been nomaios, approved within the rules. I don't know now. Perhaps it just means numerals, even if here there's no number after it. Yes, in fact, here there are numbers, but there isn't always. There are four items, number 47, 49, 86, and 85. Then follows, in each case, arge, which must be for Argos, idol, not used, followed by measurements in three dimensions in foot. The next post on the list is En Hodo Kamulku, the road of the sledge, the heavy sledge with which you transported stone until you could get it on a wagon or rollers. The next post, yes, this would be, but doesn't have to be, the road that leads down from the big, the giant column and down the pillar wadi. But it could be somewhere else, of course. In any case, our man with his clipboard is clearly walking around the quarries and often notices positions of the quarries, that it's close to the presidium, behind the presidium, or in other ways, he notices them by things that we know. To make a long story short, this inventory shows us that the basic unit was the latomia, the quarry, and gives us a tantalizing impression that we could almost follow Palais' footsteps and perhaps even identify some of the blocks that he inventorized. The third thing we learn from the Ostraca, and nowhere else, is the importance of steel. Ordinary iron is too soft to make much of an impression on granite, so quarry tools were fitted with a steel tip, or edge, which was welded on. Forge welding demands higher temperatures than were obtained in the forges next to the quarries, where the tools were regularly sharpened by reforging. When the point has been used and reforged a certain number of times, the steel tip is worn away and has to be replaced, which was done in the stomoterion. A word that we don't have otherwise, but from Mons Claudianus. I have described this in a paper that should someday appear in the Festschrift for Jean-Michel, whenever it happens to be printed on paper. My point is in mentioning it here is that without the Ostraca, we would have no idea of this procedure. Not a single tool has been found in Mons Claudianus, and even if we had one, they would be corroded and the hardness measuring would be unreliable. But now that we know that this method was used, we have the explanation why the slag in Quarry 92 shows the temperatures were obtained there, and contrary to the smaller quarries, would have permitted welding. I'm fairly certain that this identifies the forge in Quarry 92 as the Stomoterion. So, this is what I perhaps not even quite had time to tell you. And I could, of course, have centered on other things like the administration, which is mostly Hélène's domain, or the life conditions of the workers, which we find everywhere. But this will have to do. And I hope I've convinced you all that you must dig for the Ostraca in the dung heap next time you excavate a Roman quarry.